Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Aleut, an Alaska Native regional corporation serving over 5,000 Unangak shareholders and descendants with a mission to provide economic growth. Aleut's portfolio includes government contracting, real estate, technology, and energy. Learn more at aleutcorp.com.
The tax reductions that President Trump wants to continue are rolled into a large bill that requires big cuts to Medicaid and food support programs. The president and supporters call it a beautiful bill, but healthcare and food security advocates say the bill would hurt Alaska's most financially vulnerable residents. If the U.S. Senate passes it, what changes would be required for Alaskans to access Medicaid coverage and food assistance programs, and how are providers here preparing for a potential increase in need with fewer resources? We'll discuss it today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. The president calls it the One Big Beautiful Bill. Critics call it something else. The legislation that seeks to extend Trump's tax cuts and attempts to pay for it in part by cutting social safety net programs narrowly passed the House by one vote. Its fate is less certain in the Senate as lawmakers comb through it and consider how the cuts to Medicaid and SNAP, also known as food stamps, will affect their constituents. In Alaska, more than one in three residents gets health insurance through Medicaid. Here to help us understand how Alaskan health care facilities and food assistance programs could be affected is Jared Kosin. Jared is the president and CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association. And also in the studio today is Kara Durr. Kara is the CEO of the Food Bank of Alaska. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Jared and Kara, the bill is with the Senate right now. We know that Congressman Nick Begich voted for it. Let's hear from him about why he supported it.
You know, this is a great bill for Alaska. It preserves the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So it keeps taxes low for working Americans, working Alaskans. It also drives some accountability in some of the government programs that are safety net programs. So it ensures that people who have the ability to work, able-bodied folks, are either working or looking for work or perhaps volunteering. Basically 20 hours a week, making sure that those folks are contributing to the same systems that other working Americans are contributing to. It preserves the programs for the needy, which I think is really important and was a priority for the conference, the Republican conference.
And I want to note here that we've repeatedly invited Congressman Begich to be on Talk of Alaska, but so far to no avail. Jared, more than 200,000 Alaskans are covered by Medicaid. So how many of them would be vulnerable to losing their health insurance coverage if the current legislation was passed?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Right now, the Congressional Budget Office is the main body. It's a non-political body that scores these legislation, which means they're trying to estimate what the impact's going to be. And based on their estimate right now, it's looking like we're going to see a displacement or a loss of coverage around 15.3% is what their numbers show. If you apply that to Alaska, we're talking about 40,000 Alaskans are at risk of losing Medicaid overnight.
All right. That's a large number of folks. And we'll drill down a bit as to why here in a bit. But Kara, turning to you, who would be at most risk of losing access to Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, or food stamps, if the Senate votes to approve this current bill?
It's really hard to say because we don't know how some of these provisions will play out because it's the first time we're seeing these policies. Roughly 70,000 Alaskans rely on SNAP, and honestly, they all could be at risk of losing it if some of these provisions go through. For example, there is a cost-sharing provision that is put forward generally, or historically, the federal government pays for 100% of SNAP benefits, but there is a proposal to shift some of those costs to states. And we don't know what will happen if our state cannot or will not pay their cost share amount. The program could go away.
Yeah, and again, we'll drill down a bit on some of those concerns in a while as we go forward here on Talk of Alaska. But for both of you, senators have proposed some additional changes to this legislation, but they also want to start voting on it later this week. Are you aware of what could change in that Senate version? And would those changes, are you hearing that any of the changes would help with Medicaid and SNAP concerns?
You know, none of this helps. I mean, we really have to take a step back and consider this whole thing. Frankly, the Senate version is actually harsher in many respects than the House version. You know, we heard Congressman Begich talking about these work requirements for able-bodied people. There are certain exemptions built in, people that have children with severe disabilities. And there's an exemption if you have a child who's 18 or under with a disability. And the Senate went and said, no, only people who have children who are 14 and under with a disability don't have to meet these requirements. I offer that as an example just to show that the type of tinkering and additions are not improvements. They're harsh ways to try and make this harder for people to get their insurance.
So are you saying that under the Senate version, if you have a child that's 15 with severe disabilities, you're still going to be required to work?
That's as far as we understand it. And looking at the work requirements, yes, that's a plain reading in the bill. And if I'm wrong, I'm happy to admit that. But this is just a pattern we're seeing from the House and the Senate of just egregious provisions like that. And there's so many of them tucked in that unless you're taking the time to really evaluate the fabric of the bill, it's shocking.
And as we know, some folks need full-time care. So if the parent would have to work, they would have to pay to have someone be with their child.
Look, that's the whole point of the Medicaid program and the idea of a social program. You know, another example is, you know, both the House and the Senate want you to be evaluated every 6 months to see if you're eligible to be in Medicaid. And I'm talking about the Medicaid expansion population, which is about 72,000 people. Every 6 months, they want the state to check in with you, have you file paperwork to see if you should be in the program anymore. We all know how hard paperwork is, especially with the state. Right now, it's at least every year. They want to shrink that to every 6 months because the whole intent here is the more people who lose coverage, the less the federal government has to spend, and thus the less this, quote, big, beautiful bill costs. So this is nothing but harmful for Alaskans and anyone else who relies on these services.
Kara, have you seen anything that in the Senate version or any changes that have been proposed that gives you hope or causes more concern?
I would agree with Jared. You know, it's all tinkering at this point. There are some provisions that are improved. They're still very bad and very harmful. So whether it's the House version or the Senate version, this is bad legislation, and this is going to take food assistance and health care away from many, many Alaskans.
Yeah, Lori, just to give another example, and I don't know if this thing's going to make the cut or not, but there's a provision floating around the Senate that if you have Medicaid and you're in the expansion population, which the federal government's obligated to cover 90% of the cost, if you lose your expansion status for any reason, if there's an error in the paperwork, if the state screws up and kicks you off, then the Senate is considering reducing their match to the state government. So no matter what reason you would get kicked off the rolls, the federal government from that point forward would pay you half of what they currently pay. So, you know, again, I don't know if that'll make the cut at the end of the day, but the point is this is just throwing anything against the wall to see how they can try and make this look better from a cost standpoint when they're just doing real harm to people.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're discussing the tax bill that's in front of the Senate that would try to pay for those tax cuts by cutting Medicaid and food assistance programs. In the studio with me today is Jared Kosin. Jared is the president and CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association. And also in the studio is Kara Durr. Kara is the CEO of the Food Bank of Alaska. So, Jared, the Medicaid program is a federal-state partnership. States cover upfront costs. The feds reimburse at least 50%. You were just saying that that could change, especially for the expansion. Is that 50% rate true in Alaska?
Yeah, generally speaking, different populations get different match rates from the federal government, and this is all long-standing laws that have been in place. Generally speaking, by rule of thumb, you'd say Alaska pays 50%, the federal government pays 50%. You know, if it's Medicaid expansion, different population, federal government pays 90, Alaska pays 10. If it's a tribal beneficiary, the federal government pays 100%, but as a general rule of thumb, it's easier to say it's 50-50.
50-50. A report by NBC News said every state except Alaska collects Medicaid provider taxes. Describe what these taxes are and why doesn't Alaska get them?
Yeah, it's a really good question. This is really complex stuff. I'm just going to start by saying that. But these provider taxes, again, years ago, this was a funding mechanism where states will tax their providers and use that tax revenue to draw down federal matching funds and then distribute that match back to providers in a way where basically state governments who have cut the Medicaid program severely don't have to be obligated on as much of the bill. So I know that wasn't a good explanation, but the point is basically you're taxing your providers and you're using that money to pull down more federal funds. And, you know, there's a real target on it. People will call it a scheme. People will call it money laundering. We don't have one in Alaska. Why we don't have one, I don't know. I think right now we're the only state in the country that doesn't. But the long and short of it is this is a longstanding funding stream that a lot of other states have relied on to fund their Medicaid populations.
And how do you see this possibly indirectly hitting Alaskans in the future?
Well, when you look at it, a lot of people right away are, oh, we don't have a provider tax, so these other states are trying to cheat the federal coffers. It's not true. This has, again, been a longstanding laws that have allowed this type of funding mechanism. And now Congress is just trying to just get rid of it overnight. You can't do that to state budgets. Our primary concern is a lot of our citizens go out of state for care. I can tell you in 2024, 5,700 Alaskans went to Washington and Oregon alone for a hospital visit. That could be emergency care, it could be an outpatient surgery, whatever it may be. If you're one of those 5,700 people who left the state for care just in Washington and Oregon, you might not have that opportunity going forward because those states are going to get crushed by these changes to the provider taxes. Their Medicaid programs will suffer and their capacity is going to constrict. And if it constricts, that means they have less room and they're going to be prioritizing their own citizens. So I think these provider taxes have a real threat to us by virtue of what it's going to do in the lower 48.
Kara, talk about the proposed SNAP changes within the Senate bill and what it would mean for the food bank system here in the state.
Yeah, so Food Bank of Alaska, we work statewide through a network of about 150 partners to distribute food to people in need. We're doing grocery rescue, we are administering federal programs, and that all goes out to people in need. We also do outreach and application assistance for the SNAP program because we recognize it is such a critical piece of the hunger puzzle. You know, it's the largest nutrition program that we have, and it is really our first line of defense. So we follow any proposed changes or cuts to SNAP very closely, and we are very concerned about what this could mean in our state because we know and we've seen this play out when, you know, we had a recent backlog, of course, for SNAP where people were delayed in getting their benefits, waiting. we see those same people come to our partners. You know, we are already operating at max capacity. So the concern of big cuts to SNAP would really send more people to our partners, and it's just not a gap that we can fill.
When cuts happen, or when there is a backlog of applications, as we saw in the past, how does that food insecurity ripple out from families to communities? How are people getting help to feed families when cuts or holdups happen?
Yeah, it's important to note, as you said, that this doesn't just affect the people that depend on these programs. It can affect communities. So, for example, in rural Alaska, many of the grocery stores are receiving SNAP benefits, and they are under threat of closing if SNAP were to go away or if there were to be dramatic cuts. So then a community is losing their store. I know there's some concern with the Medicaid cuts in rural clinics and hospitals as well. So, you know, you could look at a rural community losing a grocery store and a clinic, and what impact does that have on the community itself?
You talked about grocery rescue. What is that?
Grocery rescue. So, you know, grocery stores will have items that they can't sell or are not going to sell that they can donate to food banks for a tax write-off. So we will then rescue that food. It's still, in most cases, perfectly good for people to consume. They're just not going to be able to sell it. And then we have volunteers that sort through it. And as long as it's still safe for human consumption, we give it to our partners. And if it's not, we give it to pig farmers so it stays in the food system.
Okay.
And Lori, it's having these conversations. I just hope we all kind of pause right there and think about this. We're talking about taking food away from people. We're talking about kicking them off their healthcare coverage and making it harder for them to access care. All for what? And you know, we heard that soundbite. People have argue that I'm just trying to scare people, but you just heard it. We're talking about taking food away from people, and the end game here is to fund tax credits. Fine, you want to fund tax credits, you know, I'm not going to comment on that. But at the end of the day, we talk about, is this good? Is this sustainable for our state, for the country? Let's not forget, this adds $2.4 trillion to the deficit over the next 10 years. So we're going to take food away from people who already cannot get food. We're going to take healthcare coverage away from people who cannot afford it. And then we're going to add $2.4 trillion to the deficit over the next decade. How is that good for anybody?
Well, let's hear from Congressman Begich again. This is from part of an interview that Alaska Public Media's Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin got with the congressman.
On the safety net programs, the changes to SNAP would require the state to come up with about $68 million to continue it, and that's coming up now sooner than, I believe it's 2026, by the end of 2026. How do you think the state can meet that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So the state has the highest level of improper payments of any state in the country. And part of that is because of a misinterpretation of who was should be accepted as a proper beneficiary of the SNAP program. That, my understanding, has been resolved, and we have a much lower improper payment rate today than we did in 2023, which is the most recently reported numbers that we have. And so—
But isn't 2023 the look back that they're looking at for this next—
Well, we have a year to get this right. And I believe that the state can get it right. A number of other states have gotten it right. And I think that we need to look to other states for how we go about ensuring that the people that are receiving the benefit are properly vetted and the appropriate recipients for the benefit. I think we can do that. I think at the end of the day, we need to drive some accountability in the system. That 60% of the payments that were going out from Alaska, from the state of Alaska, to recipients were improper. And the national average is 11%. And we're hoping to get that down to under 5%. And I think that that is an achievable goal. And I certainly believe that our government in Alaska can achieve that with the proper investment. And I expect that they will.
And again, we've repeatedly invited Congressman Begich to be on Talk of Alaska for the past several months without success. Kara, what's your response to Congressman Begich's claim about improper payments? He said, because of a misinterpretation of who should be accepted as a proper beneficiary of the SNAP program.
So we do have the highest error rate in the nation, and this is based on a misinterpretation of COVID regulations. It's not that people were getting the benefits that shouldn't be, or they were getting the wrong amount. They had a waiver that they could just roll people over, you know, rather than reapplying or recertifying every 6 months during COVID because they were so inundated. They could roll this over and just automatically keep people on. People are still required to report changes in income, anything that might not make them eligible. Because they did that and they were supposed to actually have people reapply, they have this tremendous error rate now. But I wouldn't say that it's people getting the benefits that shouldn't be or that it's improper.
Cost sharing between the Fed and states would change from 50-50 to more of that burden falling on the states. Is it known what the increased cost would be for Alaska, and what happens if the state can't cover or refuses to cover that full cost?
Yeah, so this is you know, tens of millions of dollars, you know, could be upwards of, you know, $68 million, I think, under the House bill that the state would suddenly have to shoulder. You know, we just came out of legislative session where the state had some budget requests. Not all were granted. And these are really reasonable requests and things that they need to continue to operate the program efficiently and get people the benefits they need. So obviously we are in a financial crunch as a state. So to throw on this extra burden is really, really challenging. And we don't know what the state would do and what the outcome would be. They would have a couple options. They would pay that cost sharing amount. They would say we can't pay it, and then benefits could be reduced, or they would just say we're not going to do the program because we can't afford it anymore.
So it's possible for the state to just completely bow out of food assistance.
Yeah, we haven't really got any clear answers. I know these questions have been asked a lot in Congress and have been kind of sidestepped. So we don't actually know what the impact would be, but it seems like that is a potential consequence.
Let's go to the phones for a moment. David is in Palmer. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having this program. It's very important. Most people don't realize what's happening with this bill. I visited Nick Begich's office in early June and asked how that was in D.C. and how they plan to achieve $800 billion in Medicaid cuts without harming people who are already relying on it. They told me the savings mostly come from removing immigrants and so-called able-bodied recipients from the program. When I asked what percentage of the $800 billion would come from those cuts, they couldn't even give me a rough estimate. So my question to the panel is this. Can you explain how removing who are considered able to work from Medicaid adds up to $800 billion in savings?
Yeah, David, great question. No, the math does not add up. You're completely correct with that question. I would add on to your question or make a point. And I'm not trying to pick on the congressman, but how do you come back? You know, remember, this is his state. We are his constituents. How does he come back and tell us it's a good idea to penalize us for having a high error rate? There's nothing good about that for our state. And I would remind him, too, that this error rate that we're talking about, we're concerned. We have high error rates when it comes to Medicaid eligibility. And this bill contemplates penalties for states with high error rates. So the very same individuals who have a 60% error rate in administering their program are going to be asked to administer these eligibility checks for Medicaid now every 6 months instead of a year. It's crazy. And, you know, the last thing I would say, too, is Kara pointed this out. Congressman Begich, you know, seemed confident that this can happen. We just need some investment. Kara is absolutely correct. With the budget crunch in our state, there were positions requested in the Department of Health that were not approved and didn't make the cut. So we're not investing in these programs. We're expecting them to do more, be more efficient, and have better results. To answer your question, David, how do you get to $800 billion in savings? We're all going to pay more. Our state budget's going to pay more. You're going to pay more for care. The math doesn't add up. It's a farce.
Thanks for the call, David. We have an email from Helen saying the Alaska Health and Human Services are very slow on processing applications and renewals. I had to wait almost a year for SNAP benefits. I'm still waiting on Medicaid. She says, this system is creating homelessness. We spend money on food and medicine and get behind on everything else. So kind of laying out what some people are struggling with there. Jared, as you noted, 15% of Alaska's population losing benefits would be about 40,000 people, I think you said. Alaska Public Media's reporting showed that the entire healthcare system in Alaska is quite dependent on Medicaid, 25% for Providence, 34% for the Anchorage Neighborhood Health Clinic, and 40% for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Do you have an idea of what the reductions would be for these entities?
Oh, man, these are such hard questions, and it's amazing to me. You know, we're sitting here all trying to do exercises on paper, and it's so quick to forget that these are people, and these are people that need services. What I expect the greatest impact to be is I think it's going to start in our rural areas first. I think our rural facilities have the least ability and cushion to absorb impact. And they have a higher proportion of their patients and population that are covered by Medicaid than our urban areas. And so what I would expect is if you see a loss of coverage around 38,000 Alaskans, and we didn't even talk about the enhanced premium tax credits, I'll save that, you're talking about thousands of people overnight without coverage who are going to need care. Here's where it gets tricky. They no longer have anywhere to go. They won't be able to be seen by their doctor. So they're going to wait. They're going to get sicker. And eventually they're going to show up to the emergency room. That's going to create longer, more complex visits, and none of which will be compensated, meaning it's going to have to be absorbed by the facilities. That means your rural hospitals are going to have to absorb millions in uncompensated care because of these changes. And you have to ask yourself, are they in a position to absorb millions in uncompensated care? I'll answer that for you. The answer is no. So then you're talking about service closures or facility closures, and it's a very real threat.
All right. On that note, we are going to take a break, and we will continue our discussion about potential cuts to food assistance programs and Medicaid as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing President Trump's tax bill that would pay for those extension of those tax cuts by cutting Medicaid and food assistance programs. Jared Kosin, President and CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association, and Kara Durr, CEO of the Food Bank of Alaska, are both in the studio with me today. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. John is in Eagle River. Hello, John.
Yes, hello.
You have a story you'd like to tell us?
Yes. My spouse went down with early onset dementia, about 63, and I dealt with all of the different agencies, the IRS, Medicare, Medicaid, and disability, all that stuff. And I'll tell you, if I didn't have Medicaid to help her, it would have been an absolute disaster. You know, I could have lost my house and, you know, and it was nip and tuck all the way. You know, of course, the paperwork issue is difficult, but that's something different, and I'm fine with that. The issue is this apparent thinking that somehow people who use Medicaid or other services like that are not pulling their weight and they're going to cut us off. I just don't get it. You know, where's the social compact?
Well, thank you, John, for helping us understand some of the struggles that folks are having, real life struggles that you're having with this. Thanks for the call. I wanted to kind of follow up there with John's statement about Medicaid. Jared, you had said before that, you know, this is not a government handout, but that's often the implication that opponents say of the program, that people are taking money from the government that shouldn't be and they need to work. How do you counter that handout argument?
Well, I think people like John counter that. When we have these exchanges and we refer to them as they, when we create this mythical person, and this is what they're doing in Washington, D.C. Well, we have, you know, Bill, the 27-year-old living with his parents on the couch playing video games, and he's just sucking the system dry. I have yet to meet Bill, but I'm being told Bill is everywhere, and he is taking. I'm sorry, this is a whole way to try and dehumanize this. But then you talk to constituents, you talk to actual Alaskans like John, who point out that, hey, this is a program I needed, and it was crucial in my greatest time of need. You know, if you look at polling around the Affordable Care Act, now that it's been depoliticized, enough time has passed, it's a very popular program. People having access to healthcare coverage is very, very popular. So this bill, I cannot stress it enough, is taking your coverage away. And if you don't want something taken from you, you need to wake up and pay attention to this stuff. And you need to pick up the phone and call the congressional delegation.
Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Todd is in Anchorage and has a question about nursing homes. Hello, Todd.
Hi. Thanks for this program, guys. I know for a fact, I have some experience with this stuff, that the common thing when a person gets elderly, particularly, and debilitated and possibly demented, and goes into nursing home type care, assisted living, nursing homes, they are amazingly expensive. And what has to happen with almost all of them is they have to, quote, spend down their own money. In other words, sell any property, any possessions, drain every possible resource and money that they have, and then apply for Medicaid to help them to pay for the rest of their life in these situations. If Medicaid is reduced or cut off and all these things, what would possibly be the options for some of these folks? It's impossible. I just wonder what you guys think of it.
Thank you, Todd, for the question. As Todd referenced, you know, a lot of times people have to just exhaust every resource that they've ever built up in their life in order to go on to Medicaid to be in a nursing facility that could cost anywhere from $5,000 per month to $15,000 per month. What do you see coming in terms of nursing homes and how they will struggle if these cuts go through?
It's really hard to predict, and that assessment is completely accurate. You know, people have to spend down all of their own resources before they can get on Medicaid. So going back to that last question, what, you know, how do you get past this? People are just taking from the government. No, people have to truly spend down every penny to get to whatever eligibility threshold they need to get on Medicaid coverage to then be able to have this care in nursing homes. Nursing homes in our state, the largest portion of their income stream, their revenue stream that keeps them around is Medicaid. So what will happen? I honestly don't know. And that's what is so troubling about this is we have Congress trying to reform complex healthcare issues all across the spectrum. They're trying to do it in a matter of days and weeks, and they're just throwing ideas out there, and people don't realize just how serious this could be. And I don't think anyone has an answer, but it genuinely feels like these impacts are going to be detrimental, and I would expect that to apply to long-term care as well.
Programs such as Denali Kid Care and Denali Care are part of the Medicaid program. Are there distinctions between these state programs and Medicaid, or is it the same thing?
No, there are distinctions. Denali, those are different names for the Medicaid program, so they're not just called Medicaid, and there are also distinctions for the populations that are under there. I mean, I don't want to give an incorrect statistic. I think almost half of children born maybe in Alaska are on Medicaid and Denali Kid Care. That could be wrong, so you could fact check that. But the bottom line here is, if someone from Washington is listening to this, they're going to go, no, this isn't going to hurt kids. This isn't going to hurt the elderly. This is just targeting the expansion population. That's where you're going to see it. And it's just not true. When we see a displacement, potentially upwards of 38,000 Alaskans losing coverage, everybody's going to get hit. I mean, I will tell you right now, if 38,000 people lose coverage and they are funneled to the emergency rooms like history would suggest will happen, at the same time this bill, may I remind you, cuts Medicare reimbursement to physicians. The House version increased it. The Senate cut that out. So no increases for Medicare. And I'm sure you all know how hard it is to get Medicare to see a physician in Anchorage. This is all to say that as soon as this event happens and it starts to take hold, you'll see service closures or restrictions, and you'll see this impact everyone, and you're going to see a large cost shift over to everybody else because someone's going to have to fund the sustainability, and that often gets pushed to private pay. So anyone who has employer-based insurance, anyone who's paying for individual insurance, your premiums are going to go up.
That expansion that happened in 2015, since that time, I believe the statistic was that that unpaid hospital bills have dropped by about half. And so what do you anticipate would happen if these cuts go through? What's that going to look like for hospitals?
Yeah, see, everybody's rapidly trying to do math and predict these things, and it's so hard to do in a matter of hours and days. The latest figure I saw was calling for a 5% increase in uncompensated care. I don't know how valid that statistic is. I just know if 38,000 individuals no longer have a payer source, you have to figure they're going to need health care at some point, and who's going to cover that? Essentially no one.
All right, let's go back to the phones for a moment. Amber is in Anchorage. Hello, Amber.
Hi. A few months ago, I had the opportunity, when they first started talking about these cuts, Rep. Nellie Jimmy hosted an event out in Bethel, and about 80 folks showed up to talk about what Medicaid cuts would do to them. Based on what's in this bill right now, Jared, what do you think will happen in rural Alaska?
I think, you know, I would tie my answer, thank you for that. I would tie my answer to what we were talking about with the food bank too. You're going to see less access. Access will be harder. So if you need healthcare, it's going to now become harder for you. There's going to be more administrative barriers, and there's going to be loss of coverage. And so in rural Alaska, what I would anticipate happening is decisions are going to have to be made about sustainability. How does a healthcare facility or clinic sustain itself? If in that scenario, you're talking about restricting services, you're talking about layoffs. I mean, the healthcare industry is the largest employer in the state. We employ 44,000 Alaskans. One of the first things, you know, that you kind of do in this situation is you talk about layoffs. And then from layoffs, you go to service closures. And from service closures, you potentially talk about facilities. So I would say rural Alaska is especially vulnerable to that. And that's my concern. And I'd say the same about food stamps. And YKHC does a fabulous job in Bethel providing care. They have a beautiful hospital that is cutting edge on the type of care they're providing in such a rural frontier area. And I would say that's directly under threat.
All right. Thank you for the call, Amber. We are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about potential cuts to Medicaid and food assistance programs as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing the bill that is in front of the Senate currently, the U.S. Senate, that seeks to extend President Trump's 2017 tax cuts and would pay for it by cutting Medicaid and food assistance programs. Jared Kosin, President and CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association, and Kara Durr, CEO of the Food Bank of Alaska, are both in the studio with me today. Kara, getting back to you, how has the need for food assistance changed in recent years? Is it higher? Is it leveling off? What do you see?
Last year, we saw a big increase in the amount of need we were seeing across the state, and it's really stayed pretty steady, very high. So, you know, we see people of all walks of life needing the services. I think there's just a lot of uncertainty in the state right now. And food assistance is often the first resource that people go to because it's easy to get. And food is a squishy budget. You know, you can you need to pay your rent. Otherwise, you're going to get kicked out of your home. But you could skip a meal. You can get some food from a food pantry.
And we know that food is sort of the first line of health defense, too. It's you're at its most basic. It's medicine that you're taking in to keep your body healthy. Do you have an idea of the percent of needy families in Alaska versus how much help you're able to provide?
We know we're not meeting the needs of people in our state. You know we're only able to give food in some cases for a few days, for a few weeks. And SNAP is such a big part of that equation. And even then, SNAP benefits, they're supplemental. They're only lasting most families a few weeks. So, you know, we're always trying to do more with less, be more efficient, find new avenues of getting healthy food to people. Because it's, you know, you're right, it's not just about getting food, but it's about getting healthy and nutritious food that people want to eat that's culturally appropriate. So we're going to keep doing that. But it's a big concern to see SNAP cuts on the table because we know it's going to drive so many more people. The people that are coming already are going to need more.
And if the cuts went through, and as we know, the state is having some very severe fiscal constraints and will continue to have those into the future, if the state said, look, we can't do this, we're going to have to bail out of SNAP altogether, what would the food bank be able to do? Where could help come from then?
Well, to put it in perspective, that the cuts being proposed are the equivalent of over 9 billion meals lost. The entire Feeding America network of food banks on an annual basis is doing about 6 billion meals, which is a lot. But you see, you know, there's no way we'd have to triple what we're doing to close that gap. And that's just not possible. And so I think we really need to think about, you know, not only the short-term impacts, but the long-term impacts. These are kids that are not getting meals. These are our seniors and elders that are skipping meals. And those have long-term consequences for us as a community.
Absolutely. Let's go back to email for a moment here. This is someone who asked to be anonymous with their question, saying, I have a daughter with diagnosed depression, which has effectively prevented her from regular employment where she interacts with others. She is currently self-employed in an animal care capacity, but earning a minimal amount of money. She receives both SNAP, Medicaid, Social Security disability payments, plus we help her with ordinary living expenses, mainly rent. How will the bill affect her?
Yeah, Medicaid is the primary payer source for behavioral health services. And if you talk to people in Washington, D.C., they're going to tell you, oh, it's okay. We have exemptions to the work requirements. It's going to be okay. The truth is, they want these work requirements to go into effect in 2026. That's next year. If your daughter even meets the exemption criteria, which is not totally clear, how do you feel about having to go apply for an exemption? Think about that. It is impossible to apply for any of these things, to go through that administrative process. We just talked about error rates from the state. It is going to be extraordinarily painful whether you meet an exemption or not. And so, unfortunately, I would say, I don't know. And I would be concerned. And I would point out, I really admire this person emailing in, and I'd point out that they signed it anonymous. There are so many anonymous people out there because it's so hard to talk about this stuff and own up to it. I mean, I know, you know, children at school, they're on SNAP benefits. Elderly people, they require SNAP. Medicaid. I want to just remind people, is this bill have, I keep looking for the underlying purpose. What is the win here? Why is this so great? Why is this so, quote, beautiful? Again, you're adding $2.4 trillion to the deficit. We're talking about generations ahead of us. How did we get here, and what are we doing?
We have an email that kind of echoes your comments. Lou writes from Nome, when is this administration going to cut the deficit? They spent most of the last campaign complaining about how high the federal debt was, and then all of DOGE claiming to reduce federal spending, yet now they are boldly adding to the federal debt to pay for tax cuts. Jared, you had said the D.C. talking points, and you've been kind of relaying some of this throughout the hour. You said the talking points saying that this bill will help the neediest on Medicaid and make the program sustainable is garbage. Describe what you meant there.
I just don't know how anyone can come home to Alaska and try and tell you why this is such a great idea. I mean, thousands of people in our state are going to lose coverage. It's indisputable. And the response to that is, well, they don't really need coverage. Well, let's go back to behavioral health. If you're in crisis and you need care, would we all agree that, well, behavioral health is fine. We have enough services in Alaska. No way. Walk down the streets of Anchorage. Look at what has happened with homelessness. Look at what has happened with mental health, substance abuse disorders. Medicaid is the key funding source for that, and we already don't spend enough on behavioral health. I mean, the governor and the legislature just prioritized that in the budget. And so we have, you know, our congressional delegation. I hope and urge them, when they look at this, I get they have other considerations that I can't possibly understand. But from a healthcare standpoint, a food standpoint, and Alaskan citizen standpoint, this is horrible policy. And so I hope they're able to explain why it's so good and why the good outweighs the bad. I cannot come up with any scenario on how that's possible. And these talking points about people sucking the system dry, or don't worry, this is just fraud, waste, and abuse. All you have to do is take a few minutes and start reading it on your own and come up with your own conclusions. And I guarantee you won't feel good about it.
For both of you, I remember in the 90s, there was, you know, a big push about welfare reform and the specter of the welfare queen just laying around collecting all kinds of money and not doing anything. And so there was a big push then for people have to work and they have to be productive. Then that sort of fell away. I don't know if there was earnest attempts at doing that. But when you think about what's behind some of that, what does it come down to for you both? Is it that there is sort of this kind of unspoken sentiment that if you need assistance, either medical assistance or food assistance, there must be something you're doing wrong? That if you're poor, somehow that's your fault. Do you face a lot of that in the work that you do?
I think there's definitely a lot of stigma around these programs still. I think COVID helped to destigmatize some of this in a way, because we saw a lot of people were, you know, a few weeks away from needing a program like this, but it still remains. The reality is the majority of people on SNAP who can work are working. Many are members of the population that we wouldn't expect to work. They're disabled individuals. They're seniors or elderly. They have young children at home. You know, this program is working as intended. There also are work requirements already for SNAP. What this increase in that policy does is it time limits benefits. And so when we think about what are the supports people need, you know, that are maybe struggling and can work and want to get back to work, well, one of those supports is food assistance, right? So now if we take away their SNAP, now they're going to have to go from pantry to pantry to get the food that they need instead of spending that time, you know, in training or looking for a job. So, you know, we're all for anything that is helping people get a leg up that need it for those that can. But this policy doesn't do that. It just takes food away from people.
And I'll give you another example. if the intentions were pure here, and we can honestly believe this was good, answer this question for me. If someone goes through an eligibility check from Medicaid expansion and the work requirements, if they fall out of the program because they don't meet them, they're barred from enrolling on the marketplace for individual insurance. So you're just damning people to no coverage at all? Like, what is that?
Why are they barred from the
That's a provision that passed in the House bill. They can't enroll. There's a prohibition because they didn't do their obligations under the work requirements. I mean, what is that? What no matter how you look at this, if you want to reform healthcare, we are at the table. And we've done it in our state. We have worked with the governor. We've worked with the legislature. We've worked with stakeholders. We in Alaska know how to do this. But we also recognize it takes time. These are complex. You can't shove it all together and try and do it overnight. Otherwise, you run into the situation we're in.
We have an email from David in Fairbanks who says, rural communities can't fish for salmon. And with less health care and food assistance, Native people will have to move away from traditional homelands to survive. What are the impacts of relocation of Natives spiritually and health-wise?
Yeah, and how about transportation? Think about that. If you lose your Medicaid coverage and you're in rural Alaska and you need to get to Anchorage or Fairbanks or Juneau for health care, good luck transporting yourself on top of that because that's part of covered benefit. So our healthcare system, maybe uniquely unlike many others in the lower 48, inherently relies on a social fabric aspect. And we are destroying that. And I still cannot come up with a reason why.
Kara, we know that the state had a huge backlog issue with SNAP, got sued over it. Given that backlog problem, what do you think would happen if more requirements for work or volunteering or school were added where somebody has to track, as Jared said, they're going to have to check every 6 months instead of once a year? How would the state handle that?
It would be a real challenge. They're already challenged, with vacancy rates, with hiring problems. I think they are working really hard to get out of this backlog, implement a lot of new technology solutions. But as Jared said, those things take time. They take investment from the state. So what these bills in Congress are doing right now is simultaneously adding more costs to the state that the state is not going to be able to shoulder, and more administrative requirements, which are going to make it harder for the state to implement them. It's going to undoubtedly increase our error rate because it is so administratively complex, and it's going to just make it harder for people that are already struggling to get these benefits.
Well, thank you both for being with us today. Jared Kosin is the president and CEO of the Alaska Hospital and Healthcare Association, and Kara Durr is the CEO of the Food Bank of Alaska. We could have filled 2 hours probably today discussing this concern. Thanks so much for being here. Thanks to our engineer, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose. Our editor is Annie Feit, and on the phone, Sam Ling helped us out today. Thanks for listening. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.